You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is John Page. I'm a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program for the Brookings Institution. It's my privilege to be the moderator of this panel this afternoon. The topic is the role of civil society in a new Egypt, which is a topic, I think, which is both timely and important. I was in Oxford over the weekend and speaking with a friend, and he said to me, you know, I think the Jasmine Revolution and the changes in Egypt really boil down to two things, jobs and justice. And I thought, well, one, of course, it's Oxford, it's a clever alliteration, but two, it's also quite a penetrating thought. And I think today, as we discuss amongst ourselves and with you the issue of civil society in Egypt, we have representatives from the business community, from civil society organizations, from the youth movements in Egypt. We need to keep in mind the issues of jobs and justice, and I hope the panelists will speak a bit to the role of civil society in trying to deliver both. Without further ado, let me then introduce the panelists. Their biographies are in your handouts, so I won't try to summarize their academic or professional histories. But they are a very distinguished group. And I'll begin at my far right with Shadi Hamid, who is the director of research for the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar. He's visiting us from Qatar, and we're very lucky to have him here. Sitting to my immediate right is an old friend, Nabil Fahmy, who has had a long... Hisham Fahmy. I was thinking of the distinguished Egyptian diplomat, actually, who has had a long career with the American Egyptian Chamber of Commerce in Egypt, which is the leading, one of the leading business associations in the country. To my immediate left is Jackie Camille, who is managing director of the Nadit El Maroussa Foundation, one of the co-sponsors of this event and a leading civil society organization in Egypt. To her left is Oweis Soufi, who is vice president of the International Youth Foundation, another of the co-sponsors of this event. And finally, at the far end of the table is Oweis Soufi, who is is Amira Mati, who is a program officer for the Middle East and North Africa in the National Endowment for Democracy. So quite a range of expertise and interests on the panel. We'll begin with asking each of the panelists to make about 5 minutes of remarks according to their own interests and themes. And let me begin then with Jackie Camille to my immediate left.
Hi, everyone. I'll speak about the expectations of the civil society and the needs that would actually help us do a better job in the new Egypt. So basically, the role of the civil society is, for me, is identifying gaps and issues in the systems and trying to come with innovative solutions to help close these gaps or solve them. So for example, in the area of job creation and employment, at Nahdat al-Mahroussa, we would do two things. One is creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem to support the creation of new jobs, and also we will help filling the available jobs in the market. And filling the available jobs in the market are two types, whether you help link student graduates to those jobs, or for the blue collars or the vocational track students or those who dropped out of education, we actually, because there is this culture of people not wanting to have these jobs, we work actually with employers to try to secure a good quality and better terms for the labor. To do such a job, we basically need some key areas of support. With regards to government, we basically need a regulatory environment. And with this, we mean one regulation for transparency rather than for control. We've been talking in the morning about the Ministry of Social Solidarity and how much it has been, the role of it has been hindering the progress of the work of the civil society. We want them to, yes, oversee what we're doing, but in a way that they're just making sure that we're transparent rather than just checking each and every step that we make. Two is the law versus the implementation or putting this law in application and enforcement. The law might not be as strict as how it's being implemented. So the Ministry of Social Solidarity actually imposes more restrictions on the law that is available. And so, for example, there are some rights for the NGOs that they can't actually get because the Ministry of Social Solidarity is enforcing more strict rules on the NGOs. We also care to have a space to operate and openness to partnership between government and public institutions and the civil society. We want to be perceived as a partner rather than a competitor or a challenge to the government, or that we are pinpointing their mistakes or issues. We're actually trying to help this government do a better job, so we want to be perceived as a partner. And there has been these issues in the Mubarak era that whenever an NGO was doing a good job and it's becoming large in size so that you can actually impact a large number of people, government wanted to take the credit of the work that's being done. And we have seen many of the civil society organizations being eaten up by the government institutions. From the donor side, we want to see more support to bottom-up approach to development. We want to see donors supporting locally created and designed programs to solve the issues that we know, the definition of these issues. We're the best people to create solutions for them, because we'll take so many things into consideration that probably the donors or those who are designing solutions in closed rooms will not take these things into consideration. Also, with regards to supporting scaling up and sustainability, as we were mentioning in the morning, we want to see support going to the creation of institutions rather than only programs that would go do a five-year intervention or whatsoever, and then after those 5 years are over and the funding is gone, then everything would not even go back to how it was. It would actually go back to worse than how it was, because you actually created an imbalance that you can't continue supporting the service, and the people are not at this balance that they were on before. And effectiveness of the donor dollars. We see a huge number of grants with a lot of huge amount of money that it's being, I mean, at each level, especially with the international organizational involvement, that 10 to 30% of this actual grant would go to the real beneficiaries. So we need to work on new mechanisms to make sure that we actually maximize the benefit of the real beneficiaries rather than having all these layers. Specifically for the youth-led NGOs, I think we need to start seeing a change in the patronizing culture that has been prevailing in Egypt over the past many years. The civil society used to be dominated by elder people, by a certain profile of people, and we want to see this changing, and we want to see more space given to youth so that they can actually do the change that we want to do. Talking about the coordination and part, we actually at NM, we've been, since the revolution, we've been trying to do two things. One is coordinating at the local or internally in Egypt and externally with the Egyptians in the diaspora. So, for example, last week we had this event, the Egyptian American Community Event Forum, where we're trying to engage Egyptians who are living here in the States to actually have a responsibility and a role in shaping the new Egypt. In Egypt, we're having, we were one of the leaders, not Mahrousa, were one of the leaders in creating the Egyptian youth, the Federation of Egyptian Youth-Led NGOs. And it's basically trying to create a coalition of youth-led NGOs and making sure that their role is, they actually talk to each other, understand what they're doing, and the impact of their work is maximized. I hope I'm not over my 5 minutes. Done.
Thank you. Very good, actually. Now to Hisham Fahmy, who will talk to us a bit from a business perspective.
Well, good afternoon. I guess this is a new Egypt, and getting an Egyptian to talk for 5 minutes is quite a challenge. We say sabah al khair. I was asked to talk about the business associations and what they're doing now and how they should be looking at Egypt in the long run. I represent AmCham Egypt, which is now since 1982. We have 1,800 members, and we serve the our members in the business community. On the short term, obviously, as a association, personalization is the dominant way forward in Egypt and anywhere. But there are so many challenges at the moment in Egypt on the economic front and on the business front that there are common issues to all of them. And we have identified that we really need to support our members in the different sectors. We've been talking today about civil society and their role and so on. But there are issues now at the present time in Egypt that have a tremendous effect on whether this revolution succeeds or not. And it's very critical that we do everything that makes it succeed. For instance, I just want to give some examples of what we're doing. There is obviously was a huge problem in the financial sector. The banks were closed for a long time. The stock market opened only yesterday. Our members had issues of opening LCs because Western banks or other banks were looking at Egypt as a risk, so they were not confirming letter of credits. There were transfer issues. The central bank was making sure that there were no huge transfers out of Egypt, especially for those who are under investigations. So it was very hard to transfer any funds out of the country, even for business issues. Foreign exchange, it's crept out on the first couple of days that the banks opened. About $2 to $3 billion left the country, and then there were speculators on the foreign exchange, and but the central bank stepped in. So we're from 5.8 pounds to the dollar. We're now to we're now to 5.95. I think all expectations is we'll go over to 6 pounds something. We've been helping our members or talking to our members, especially in the tourism sector. Tourism has, as you know, suffered tremendously. And that has effect on so many people. The people that work in the tourism sector, especially in the hotels and so on, their salaries are very low, and they get all their income from a 12% service charge that tourists pay. So you have thousands and thousands of people who suddenly without income. Also, the indirect effect of restaurants and so on and so forth. So we've been working with our tourism sector. We've been working with the government how to tourism companies can be relieved of some of the burdens and so on. There were issues on logistics. The ports had huge problems. Just trucking, there was a curfew for a long time. There is still actually a curfew from midnight to 6 a.m., and that sort of puts a spanner in the works when you're trying to ship stuff from Alexandria to Cairo or to the south and so on. So we've been working with the higher council of the military to get special permissions for trucks to go through it during the night and so on. Awareness, we've been working very strongly with just making aware. Don't get involved in the politics, but we get involved in the awareness. Huge discussions on the constitution or the referendums, which way to go, yes, no, what happens after yes or what happens after no, et cetera, parliamentary first or presidential first and so on, and we invite a lot of people and so on. There were obviously many, many strikes by workers and, you know, this was a revolution of people wanting better pay, better justice, better treatment, and we have to. We've been working with our members to look at human rights of the employees. Really, I mean, there are disgraceful companies that are paying very, very low wages to people, and that should. We've been working with them on how to increase that, or how to treat their employees properly, but also remain competitive in the workplace. On the long term, there's a huge skills gap between what the companies want and what the education system is spewing out. And I think business associations, we ourselves have a huge education program, and we embed a lot of the U.S. associations' curriculum in some of our educations and so on. Business matchmaking, trying to get matchmaking between U.S. companies and Egyptian companies. All this for employment. You need business. You need private sector to be back at work to get people employed. We've been promoting work ethics and culture, engaging the young in decision makings and so on. Capacity building of business association is something that is so, so essential. There are so many business associations that are voluntarily run and with maybe a charismatic leader. When that leader leaves, the association collapses. So you really need a capacity building of professional staff who can do the research, who can do the PR, who can do the events, who can do the membership, and so on. Getting business associations to know how to fundraise, how to do membership development, advocacy, and coalition building. All this has to be done by the business associations, and it can be. It just needs the encouragement of the private sector, the members, and the whole world, quite honestly. We had a huge party in Tahrir Square, and the bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. We're now suffering the hangover, but hopefully we'll come out of it quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Hisham. Next is Awais Sufi, who, from his perspective as an NGO in the U.S., will talk to us a bit about what the external NGO community may be looking for and trying to do in the coming months and years.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you to the Brookings Institution for hosting us today. The International Youth Foundation is a global NGO. We work in over 70 countries around the world, and we have been very pleased to have been working in Egypt for the last 6 or 7 years alongside of our partner, Nadat al-Mahrousa, but a whole host of others, global NGOs, multinational companies, local companies, local civil society organizations, and, of course, to the extent possible, government. As we have watched what has unfolded in Egypt over the last few months, we have been, like everyone else, very excited about the possibilities. We have seen a youth-led revolution. Our own approach is an asset-based approach to youth development, meaning how can you use youth as assets to confront, address, and solve societal challenges. And obviously the youth of Egypt have been instrumental in, you know, changing the game in Egypt. And now I think the real key will be how can international organizations such as ourselves and the many others that are represented here in Washington and globally support youth as well as all of Egyptian society in terms of moving forward. In that respect, I wanted to kind of talk about two or three, maybe four things that are particularly relevant from our perspective at the International Youth Foundation in terms of, as John had mentioned, what the international community can do. The first I'd like to mention is bringing in new consensus-based approaches, public-private partnership-building approaches to push forward Egyptian development. As you have seen from the last few months, there is an enormous number of voices through institutions, through individuals that are out there that are really have been silenced for a long time, or if they have been speaking, they haven't been speaking fully clearly or as loudly as they would like. The key now will be, however, to create a framework for that type of dialogue to go forward. I think there are some internationally tested models and approaches that many of the civil society organizations around the world have adopted that we should really be looking at to integrate in the Egyptian context so that we can have a systematic, consensus-based discussion around what is it that people are doing currently, where is it they continue to perceive gaps, and how is it that they can ultimately work together to address those gaps. These kinds of dialogues will be challenging. There's a lot of voices, as I mentioned, but they also need to be opportunistic. How is it that we can build some momentum around some concrete avenues for change and for stimulus of an economy, of civil society, particularly now that the aftermath, the hangover, as Hisham mentioned, is in effect. Let's see what aspirin or whatever medication we can put in for immediate relief. Second of all, I would say another place that we really need to be focusing quite heavily on is capacity building for civil society. The Mubarak regime had systematically, comprehensively decimated the NGO sector. It was part of the way of ensuring adherence to the old order. And at this point now we have an opening. But however, those organizations are going to need just the core institutional capacity building support that rich civil societies, are able to benefit from. Things that are very simple, very, very practical: budgeting, financial management, human resources, operational strategy, the basics about how you build and grow and sustain an organization so you can create a long-term enabling environment for the development of the country. Alongside of the institutions, I think we need to also be focusing on specific technical and programmatic areas that those institutions should be focusing on. Certainly, they're all interested in employment and entrepreneurship. Those are hugely important areas. There is business interest in stimulus. There is international donor relations or interest in stimulus. How can we equip the civil society organizations with the capacities to help support those things along the way? In the same token, kind of the other side of the coin, I would say we really need to be looking at creating an enabling environment for the creation of programs, particularly around employment and entrepreneurship. So how is it that the international community can work in very close partnership with local organizations, help them build their capacity and ultimately their leadership capabilities to take forward very concrete ways of ensuring quality outcomes in terms of employment, so how you conduct concrete and effective labor market assessments, how it is that you develop and design curricula modules that will be suitable to the business community, how is it that you integrate job placement strategies that ensure long-term success in the marketplace for a young person that's entering into a new job. And then on the other side, in terms of entrepreneurship, similarly, how is it that you create access to financing alongside of strong business development support services where a young person or anybody for that matter can receive good, candid advice and quality advice around how they can build and grow an enterprise to create the kinds of jobs that are going to be needed for a country of 85 million people that is in dire needs of economic activity. So these are the types of things that are out there that need to be kind of pushed forward. The last thing I'll mention is just that I think one real opportunity now, and this will take some creative thinking, hopefully from the international community, but certainly with strong partnership and really leadership from local civil society in Egypt, is this idea of leveraging the enormous energy and excitement around the rebuilding of Egypt. Egypt is a country that I've worked with many years, and it's just amazing. This is a place that is amongst the oldest civilization in human history, maybe the oldest. And they have such an enormous cultural and historical foundation to be built upon. I was amazed in Cairo just a few weeks ago to see how clean the streets were for the first time. I mean, the fact that individuals took up the responsibility in the absence of other formal authority to keep up their communities, to protect their communities. This is an energy that can be built upon, and it's something that we need to look at models of what we would call service learning. How is it that we can use this type of framework where people are excited and interested in building their communities and then using that as a means of building skills, as a means of developing opportunities for employment, for entrepreneurship, for bigger and broader development of maybe the tourism sector or other just local redevelopment initiatives. It's an energy that needs to be harnessed, and I think the international community there too can help push it in the right direction. So hopefully that will start us out, but look forward to any comments from you as well.
Thanks, Oways. One of the deeply held values of Egyptian and indeed Arabic culture is hospitality. Hisham is worried that there are people standing in the back of the room who could actually be sitting up here. So if any of you would like to come forward and have a seat, we are going to go on for about another hour. And while your back will be on C-SPAN for just a minute, he would feel better, I would feel better, and probably any other of the members of the panel would feel more comfortable if you were actually seated. Now, turn to Amir Amati, who is with the National Endowment for Democracy, who have had a long history of involvement in the region and in Egypt, and who's going to offer some thought on where we go from here in terms of building democracy.
Thank you. I'm going to focus my comments on civil society organizations that have worked on democratization, political reform, and human rights. And some of the comments will echo what Jackie had mentioned about the development organizations and also what other panelists talked about in terms of capacity building. In the pre-January 25th revolution environment in Egypt, civil society was restricted by the regulatory climate and security climate that affected their ability to move and operate. They were also affected by a population that was largely seen as apathetic. This has changed, of course, in the post-revolution environment. And now there is a huge opportunity for civil society organizations to serve as the link between state and society at large. A couple of key opportunities that exist now for civil society organizations in Egypt. The first, I would say, is setting the agenda during the transition process. And that includes activities like consensus building, policy analysis and recommendations, targeted and effective advocacy. A second point is keeping the momentum for change going and monitoring the transition process. And that includes such activities as monitoring and disseminating information on the transition process, grassroots campaigns, community education and mobilization efforts, essentially to keep the pressure going for effective democratic reform. Another area I would say is pushing open spaces and sectors that have previously been closed or restricted by the state, including that would include a wide range of legislative reforms concerning opening up the regulatory environment that restricts NGOs, political parties, professional associations, labor unions, and other institutions in Egypt. And also engaging with sectors that have largely been closed off to civil society, including universities, student clubs, and of course the media, and especially broadcast media, which has been very much restricted. And another point I would add is ensuring greater transparency and accountability on the part of decision makers, especially at the local levels where there are still elements from the former regime. And I would add to the accountability and transparency that there's a need to go beyond monitoring policy and practice, but also to look at fiscal policy and expenditures, which is an area that needs to be developed within Egyptian civil society. Finally, I would add that there's one sector that's been largely absent from the larger political reform discussions, and that's the small and medium enterprises, which will play a very important role in linking kind of the economic realities with political reforms. And there have been some inklings of associations that have developed within that sector, but they need to play a more active role in the policy setting. In terms of the challenges that are facing these groups that need to be addressed in this period, as Jackie mentioned, there were three categories of priorities that we had identified for supporting civil society efforts. One is supporting coordination efforts. The second is scaling up successful models. And the third is measures for sustainability. In terms of supporting coordination efforts, it's very important to know that there are already some coalitions that are forming within Egyptian civil society. There have been some very good examples, such as the Front to Defend Protesters that was established actually a year ago to provide legal assistance, medical assistance, and follow up on and report detentions of political activists and protesters. There's another coalition of about 200 development and civic organizations that has been forming to basically promote active and informed engagement and civic education. There's also a coalition of 16 human rights organizations that, within 2 days of Mubarak's resignation, issued a roadmap with concrete recommendations, sector by sector, on the reforms that need to take place during the transition process, and have subsequently created an action plan to correspond with the roadmap. There's also a coordination committee that unites between the different coalitions. So there are some local organic coalitions that are forming. There's still some division within civil society, but these are initiatives that need to be supported. And I would caution against supporting them financially. I mean, they've been working on a voluntary basis. The greater need is to support them through technical assistance. In terms of strengthening linkages between different civil society actors, this is another important point for coordination efforts. Over recent years, there's been a blurring of lines between the different forms of civic institutions. There's been a blurring of the lines between NGOs, political parties, unions, associations, media. There needs to be a better definition of each of these entities and an understanding of how they each work together as part of a puzzle to reach a collective objective. And I think now hopefully with the regulatory environment, hopefully there being opportunities to open that up, there may be a morphing of these different organizations and groups who found it ineffective to work as political parties or civic unions. Instead of registering as unofficial NGOs, they could potentially open and register as different institutions. In terms of scaling up, there's definitely most of the civic and political organizations have been consolidated in the Cairo and greater Cairo region. There are some groups who've emerged over recent years, especially groups that link between local governance and constituent needs. So there's going to be a need to expand beyond the capital area and to support civic and political initiatives in the governorates. I would caution against scaling up by overfunding organizations. As was mentioned before, many of the institutions in Egypt are quite weak, so we have to be very cognizant of the ability of these organizations to absorb additional funding. Finally, in terms of policy impact, instead of working in silos, it's important for the impact of these groups to be felt on a larger basis. Much money has been spent on civic education programs in Egypt, but they've been limited to a certain group of beneficiaries because there hasn't been the ability to institutionalize them, for them to be adopted within policy and implemented on a larger scale. So NGOs have to push on that level as well. In terms of sustainability, my colleagues here have touched upon the need for capacity building. There are incredible groups of activists and great innovation and creativity among civil society leaders in Egypt, but there's weak institutions, so there's a huge need for building democratic, sustainable institutions. And part of that will include the legislative reforms that we've talked about opening up the space and the restrictions that have restrained these types of institutions from operating in the past. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And last but certainly not least, Shadi Hamid has been observing and commenting on political movements in Egypt for some time, and will give us some thoughts on civil society and the political evolution.
Okay. So here's the thing. I mean, even in the best of circumstances, democratic transitions are notoriously messy, uncertain, and unpredictable. So I think we have to be aware of that from the get-go. But looking at past transitions, as we might expect, the role of civil society is extremely important in ensuring the transition process moves forward and that the demands of the transition or the revolution are actually fulfilled, not just in the short term, but over a longer period of time. And this is where civil society organizations face a major challenge, because they've been oriented around opposition. They've never had a stake in policymaking, and that's very different than, say, the role of civil society here in the U.S., where civil society is a partner with the government sometimes in terms of helping pass legislation, meeting with Congress, policymakers, and so on. So we're talking about a shift in the model. And we're really talking about, 60 years in opposition, and all of a sudden we're asking groups to decide how they're going to transition to a very new scenario. So this is unprecedented, and a lot of these groups are learning on the go. So there is going to be a learning curve there. You know, maybe a word about youth coalitions. They were obviously at the forefront of these revolutions, and a lot of people are watching what they're going to be up to in the coming phase. And this is where, we're going to see some major challenges for them. For example, if we look at the Eastern European colored revolutions, so the major youth movement in Serbia was Otpor. And after Slobodan Milosevic was overthrown, Otpor had to think about, what are we going to do in the new Serbia? And there was a lot of internal division about whether they should stay outside of the system and play the role of government watchdog, or to actually take part in the political process and maybe even in government. Eventually, they formed a political party, but they only won 1.6% of the vote in the subsequent elections. And now that youth coalitions and groups in Egypt are thinking about that, and there's a discussion about whether or not they should take part in political parties, that's an important lesson to remember. And if these groups want to become effective political forces, they're going to have to talk about not only what they're against, but provide a positive, constructive vision for Egypt's future and get into details and vision. And maybe that's one area we've been lacking. Of course, it's very early on. It's just been slightly over a month since the revolution happened. As Amira said, civil society can play a very important role in setting the agenda. And this is, and up until now, I think one problem we've seen is that these civil society organizations have gotten sucked into this debate about the referendum, and that was the number one focus. And because of that, they haven't looked at some of the more medium and long-term issues that, in my view, might be more crucial. And now that the referendum actually passed, they're put in a difficult position. We're going to have parliamentary elections and presidential within 6 months, so the time frame has become shorter. But for example, civil society can play a major role in talking about electoral design. And this is one thing that I've been harping on a lot about. What electoral system is Egypt going to have? And there hasn't really been a robust discussion about that as of yet. Currently, Egypt has a winner-takes-all majoritarian system similar to what we have in the U.S. This is not a good system for small parties. It almost makes it impossible for small parties to win. And it actually benefits larger, well-organized parties like the Muslim Brotherhood or, say, the remnants of the old National Democratic Party. So if we're talking about how to have an inclusive political transition, we want the smaller political parties to make sure that they have a stake in the political system. How do you do that? You have a proportional representation system. So even if they get 10% of the vote, they're not going to be locked out. They'll have 10% of the representation. And the fact that we haven't had this conversation is troubling, but that's precisely the kind of thing that civil society can take the lead on. But again, this is not easy because Egypt hasn't had to have that discussion for 60 years. We talk about civil society a lot here in Washington and NGOs and all of that, but there's always an elephant in the room because what's the biggest NGO in Egypt? The biggest NGO in Egypt is the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think that the conversation has become so focused around secular and liberal NGOs that we're losing sight that many NGOs in Egypt, if not most, are faith-based, similar actually to the U.S., the role that churches play in terms of providing social services, charity, and other things to the of benefit to the community. So I think we also have to have a discussion about how do secular NGOs engage with their Islamic counterparts, and also from a U.S. standpoint, how does the U.S. government engage with Islamically oriented NGOs in terms of perhaps providing assistance? Maybe funding is a little bit unrealistic, but there has to be some interface there, and up until now, we haven't really had that discussion either. So I'll just close there. Thank you.
Thanks, Shadi, and thank you for handling the microphone trauma so well. One of the fun things about being asked to moderate a panel here at Brookings is that I get to ask the first couple of questions, and I will, but let me assure you that we will then move to the audience to further ask questions, but I'm going to assert my right as chair just to ask two or maybe one, depending on how long the panelists take. As one watched the coverage unfold of the events in Tunisia and in Egypt, one couldn't escape a sense that part of the issue of justice was very much linked to the question of the economic model in both countries. And that both countries had gone through a process of economic reform, liberalization, and an opening to the private sector. And as Hisham has pointed out, unless one gets the economy going again, the issue of jobs, which was very much at the center of this, will simply not be solved. But for a long-time sympathetic viewer of the region, I think there has always been a lingering sense in many parts of these societies that the kind of economic system that came out of the liberalization effort wasn't an open system, it wasn't a fair system, it wasn't a just system. And I think at this moment, there's a real risk that there could be a backlash against the very engine that will create jobs, which is the private sector. And I was wondering if the panelists had some views on how civil society, in a way, can help balance the need for a vibrant, active, job-creating private sector with what I still think is a very deep-seated sense that there has to be a certain degree of social justice in the system as well. And so I think let me just turn to whichever of the panelists would like to try to respond. I hope all five of them from their various perspectives will. But this balance between we really desperately need jobs and we need business and we need business people, but we need an open system in which the aspirations of people to become businessmen and the way in which businessmen operate themselves create a sense of justice and fairness for all.
Well, let me try, John. This is a great question, and it's a very tough one. And I kind of wish you wouldn't have taken the moderator's prerogative to go first. But in any event, let me at least start the dialogue, because I don't think there's an easy answer to your question. You know, it is clear that the liberalization that has gone forward in the last many years has resulted in substantial disparity in terms of the economic classes that benefited substantially and the vast majority of Egyptians that did not. And, you know, that could be looked upon as a fundamental deficiency in the system of economic liberalization, or from my perspective, and candidly, I'm not an economist by trade, so I'm sure there's, you know, good educated opinions out there that either can validate this or perhaps, you know, be the contrary. But in many respects, it seems that liberalization was yet just another tool used by the government to essentially extract wealth and take from the common person. That's not to say that liberalization wouldn't have potentially had challenging implications in terms of disparity. Certainly here in the United States and other places around the world, we're seeing increasing divides socioeconomically. But nonetheless, when you have a system that enables monopolists to force privatization of major industry or major government functions and wealth and benefit greatly from a wealth perspective, it's going to cause substantial disparities and also a great deal of antagonism toward the private sector, which is, I think, kind of the source of your question. In terms of where civil society can help, I'm not sure there's, again, a perfect answer here, but I would say that we really need to be focusing on encouraging open, transparent approaches to leveling the playing field. So as we look at the creation of new systems of promoting economic growth, of trade liberalization, we need to be looking at industries at rules of the road that are applied fairly to all. And we need to do that, as we do in all societies, in a way that is consensus-based and open and transparent, but at the same time do it fairly quickly, which is the big challenge we have here, because we can't be twiddling our thumbs, noodling over new regulatory regimes for years and years here. Things have got to get moving. And so somehow I think we've got to create a framework in which the rules of the road are made clear, they're open to all, and they are creating, as I said before, an enabling environment for the type of industries that want to move forward to actually create jobs. And the last thing I would say in that, one of the things that certainly we have observed in terms of our own work in Egypt is that so much of the economic growth was really within the real estate sector and within kind of non-job creating sectors. It is a big challenge in the respect that you're having, large investments being made and they inflate growth from some perspective. But, you know, how can you encourage, for example, tourism or other types of industries that are perhaps more labor intensive and can get some people to work and make it feel comfortable that there is a vibrant private sector around?
Thanks, Oase, and thanks for being the first to volunteer. I heard a little grumbling from Hisham, so I'm going to turn to him and ask him if he wants to respond. I would remind people that he had a number of very good suggestions in his opening remarks that speak precisely to the question that I just asked.
I always grumble. let's look at 2010. Egypt for the third year, best performing emerging market. Best finance minister in the world. How much FDI, 13 before the economic crisis, $13 billion. One of the best countries to hold up during the economic crisis. Very stable exchange rate. What went wrong? Been thinking a lot about that, not just me, but a lot of people. And Dr. Yusuf Butrus-Ghali, who is the finance minister, kept saying we need 3 years for the economic growth of 7 to 8% to trickle down. Obviously, it didn't trickle down fast enough. And I go back to what Sufi was saying. It's a level playing field. It wasn't level because of the huge, huge bureaucracy that is in the Egyptian system. How many people in business here need to know a cabinet minister to get his stuff done? You don't. In Egypt, to get through the bureaucracy, if you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew the minister, get your paper signed, and that's how you moved along. So it wasn't a level playing field, and we have to get rid of the bureaucracy. It can't take 3 years for an entrepreneur to open a restaurant. It just doesn't work that way. And I think this is some of the stuff that should be done very, very quickly for anybody to, any entrepreneur who wants to do a project can do it very quickly without having to know anybody, without getting visits from 10 different regulatory authorities to, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this right, you know, until you give a bribe or something. So it needs to be done quickly, and I'm not sure how you break 7,000 years of bureaucracy very quickly. But I agree there was, I think the private sector has a huge stake in this, and they have a huge stake in making it work for their employees and for sticking to Egypt in the present time. A lot of Egyptian companies, a lot of American companies and others have made a lot of money in Egypt. And this is the time maybe to sacrifice a little and to hold on until we get through this this time. You mentioned tourism. I hope the U.S. removes the ban on travel to Egypt. It's about one of the few countries that still have that ban. And it affects not just the tourists. It affects the expatriates working with companies in Egypt and so on and so forth. So there are many things that can be done. I won't take any longer. Thank you.
I would talk specifically about what we do at Nahdat al-Mahrusa to help in the area of job creation. And we basically have, like I would say, a formula of different things. One is trying to improve the quality of education that the graduates will have. So we're trying to help build entrepreneurs, specifically social entrepreneurs, but in general entrepreneurs. Research and development is another very important thing that we try to support is this foster a culture of research and development. We don't have to keep doing what we're doing and having the exact same industries that we have, but we want to create like new sectors and support young people to start their own businesses. The culture of entrepreneurship in general. So we have offices inside the public universities, and we try to work with students on understanding that you don't have to graduate and look for a job immediately. You can actually start your own business. So instead of you getting a job, you can actually create a couple more jobs and you can have your own business once you graduate. Support for those entrepreneurs to actually survive the first few years, 2 to 3 years, and the need for incubators is a huge need in Egypt. Nahdat al-Mahrusa itself is an incubator for social enterprises, but we definitely need to see more incubators for business enterprises. And the mobilization of resources, whether that's knowledge, financial resources, technical support, mentors, role models, all these things are things that will create an ecosystem to support entrepreneurship, to help actually the creation of more jobs in Egypt, especially among youth. Thanks.
Anyone else want to stand at this one? Okay. Well, now it's your turn. What we're going to do, yes, it's going to be a lively... I think what we'll try to do is take three or four questions. If you can keep them shorter, we can take more of them. Can I ask you to identify yourself? Wait until one of our people comes with a microphone so that you can also be heard outside the room. And then we'll let the panel respond to questions as appropriate. So, well, let me start with Professor Weiss, who wanted to start before my questions.
Ibrahim Weiss from Georgetown University, way back. I'm emeritus now. I think that the title for this very important session ought to have focused on something else other than the role. The reason for this is that NGOs in Egypt had been established a long time ago, but they had been weakened because of the application of a term that we know in economics that during the gold standard was observed that the coins with less content of gold circulate, and the coins with more gold contents were melted and sold in the market. And therefore, there was a very important law that came, said that the bad currency drives good currency out of circulation. I may modify this in Egypt, and I said bad people drove good people out of circulation. So there are many organizations, they know exactly what they are doing. They were established for a specific role, but they had been handcuffed by the system. Saad al-Din Ibrahim, for example, started Ibn Khaldun. Now, Saad al-Din Ibrahim, a prominent sociologist, a professor, was thrown into jail together with other 20 other advocates simply because they monitored the election and they challenged what Mrs. Mubarak had said one time, her statement about the transparency of the election. They showed without any doubt that the elections were not clear, were not transparent, and therefore he was thrown into jail. So Ibn Khaldun and Ibn Khaldun Center can do a good job in Egypt. Furthermore, I did not hear anything about the role of the very prominent institutions in Egypt, such as Niqabat al-Ummal, Niqabat al-Muhamin, the syndicates that had played a very important role. Also, clubs that were very important, such as Nadi al-Qudha, the judges' club, Nadi al-Dubbat, that started the revolution way back in 1952, and I hope it did not happen. But this is beside the point. So the Jam'iyyat al-Iqtisad wa al-Tashri'a, that institution used to come up with an extremely important periodical, L'Egypte Contemporaine, in 1929, very important papers that had been published by Bersiani Tironi, in which he was able to show for the first time ever the elasticity of demand for the Egyptian cotton. So there are, I had the honor myself of addressing that institution, great institution in Egypt, several times, but they have been weakened because of the politicization
too many Z's.
Of the system and the impact of the National Democratic Party of imposing Nadi Sahafiyin, the syndicate of journalists in Egypt, all of those had been weakened because of the corrupt regime that imposed its own people, and therefore they let the bad people driving good people out of circulation. This is only a comment.
To Dr. Oase, I believe, which is, can you go back to the future? And I think it'd be useful for the panel to try to answer that. You know, to what extent can these institutions be revitalized and part of the transition process? Let's move to the lady in green who's had her hand up and waited patiently.
My name is Noura Siam, and I work for Institute for Inclusive Security, and I have two questions. The first one, in the last couple of weeks, there was the talk about the referendum, yes and no, and it has shown the gap between the intellectual, the youth people, and the ordinary Egyptian. So what do you think the role of civil society to fill the gap between the intellectual, the young people, and the ordinary Egyptians? And the second question is related to the relation between the civil society and the military council. Because I was watching the news, and there is a couple of unfortunate incidents. Like, there is right now a law come from the cabinet to criminalize the demonstration if it affects the job or the private sector. And I think there's a lot of question marks related to that. And also about women rights, because all of us heard about the 8th of March and what happened to women over there. So what are the role of civil society to advocate for women rights and make sure they are part of the process? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take one more question. A bit toward the back, there's a woman in blue with her hand.
Hi, my name is Robin Lieberman. I'm with Human Rights First. The Internet and telecommunications had catalyzing effects, of course, and this sector sits at the intersection of freedom of expression and association and business and entrepreneurship. So I'll just plug an event that we're having on April 6th with Esra Fattah, Abdel Fattah, and Facebook, where they'll be talking about the shutdown during the revolution. But in the context of civil society, maybe Jackie and Amira and others, if you can talk about if and how you use social networking sites and what needs to happen to ensure that they can operate freely and to maximum benefit for civil society. And also, given that many of these are U.S.-based companies, is there a role for U.S. policy to promote the freedom to connect?
Thank you. My name is John Whitman. I teach at Babson College. Thank you all for your really excellent presentations. Jackie, I was especially interested in your comment about more bottom-up development, and I was wondering if you could operationalize that maybe with some examples, and also to ask whether the model of cooperatives and particular worker cooperatives can play a constructive role here. Thank you.
Okay, let's come back to the panel, let them respond to this set of questions, and then I think we probably will have time for at least one more round in addition to that one. I think perhaps the most efficient way to do this is just simply to start at the right and work our way across and let people select questions that they would choose to answer. If any remain unanswered at the end, you'll have to catch them at coffee after the meeting is over.
Okay, so I'll start with Dr. Oase's comment, but maybe take it from a little bit of a different angle. Civil society is not all good, and actually, a lot of what we called civil society wasn't really civil society. I mean, NGOs weren't always NGOs; they were gongos or government-organized NGOs. So they were effectively part of the existing power structure and actually contributed to the perpetuation of autocracy. And they serve the purpose of letting off steam and giving the illusion of some change without the substance of it. And this was actually a big portion of civil society. And many of those organizations are still around. We'll see how they make the transition to revolutionary Egypt. But I think that was one of the mistakes with this whole civil society-oriented approach of the U.S. and European donors. They were funding organizations that weren't necessarily interested in real structural substantive change. On the issue of the gap between intellectuals and ordinary Egyptians, we really saw that with the referendum. I mean, much of secular civil society voted no, and they were in the minority. And it turns out that You know, it's the same complaint that we've had for a long time. They're kind of out of touch. And this is concerning. Now, I don't know exactly know what the solution is to that, but developing stronger links with people on the ground and kind of going beyond this NGO bubble where a lot of people have the same opinions and sometimes believe that the majority is with them, but then they become surprised when the referendum results come out and they lose by a landslide. And again, that's where we get to this issue of elite NGO. The military, I think that was also part of your question. The military is a problem, and I think a lot of us got maybe a little bit too excited about their role and thought that they were really going to be the savior of the people and all of that. We heard all that kind of rhetoric, but it turns out, I mean, the military was always the backbone of the regime, so why people thought that was always somewhat of a mystery to me. But the military is showing its true colors in terms of torturing protesters, really shocking stories that are coming out now. Very, very depressing. And now that they're criminalizing demonstrations, I mean, how much more counter-revolutionary can you be? The problem with civil society trying to interface with the military is that the military is a black hole. There's no clear channels of communication. So if there's something that's bothering you, who exactly do you talk to in the military, and who is that person going to relay the message to, and how are they going to implement that change? No one quite knows, in part because no one knows a lot about the Egyptian military. It's a somewhat opaque organization. So in that sense, I think it's pretty good that they're going to be out within 6 months, and that's one of the positive results of the yes referendum result, that they're out in 6 months. Then we can really start with civilian rule and having a more responsive government in Egypt.
Dr. Awais, again, I think the maybe the positive thing that's come out recently is that private unions now can be formed, and they don't need the approval of the government. That's something that is that is positive, and I think there is space now for all these good institutions, whether to come back or others to come back to replace them with good people and good institutions. So I think there is hope there. I'm not pessimistic on the institutions, new institutions to come up and to fill the void. And there are a lot of good young people who are very intellectual, very thoughtful, and I think that's something that's going to happen. Maybe I take issue with the. The people who said no are out of the out of touch. Just because you lose a referendum or you say no and the majority say yes does not mean you're out of touch. I think it was. I certainly expected that it was going to be a yes vote. Obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood are much, much more organized than any other institution. So. And for the yes vote, they also had the remnants of the NDP pushing people to say yes. So whether it's yes or no, I think it was an incredibly good event. We had incredibly huge number of turnout. There were people standing there in queue for, you know, 3, 4, 5 kilometers. It was quite a scene, and everybody's coming out with their finger, you know, fluorescent. I mean, I took a picture of mine. So, I take issue about that. What happened in Egypt, and a friend of mine who's head of CIB Bank explained it. He says, like you had a bottle of champagne, and you kept doing this to it over the years. And then near the two of this last elections, the parliamentary election, you start smashing this thing on you know, and it two things could have happened. Either it breaks and the glass hurts everybody and you get people killed and so on, or the cork comes out and you get a mess. And we're lucky, I think we got the cork out and it is a mess. I think Libya is another story. So I think the military, honestly, it has tried to do its best. I think they're out of their depth now. They're really they're listening to everybody and everybody is telling them what to do. I'm also a little worried about this this new law. But I think because they're listening to people saying, listen, we're not getting the work done. Everybody's demonstrating outside their factory, trying to get out of their bosses, and you know they want triple salary and so on. I think that's where it's coming from. I wasn't there when that came out, so I maybe I'll give him the benefit of the doubt since he's going the other way.
I'll do three things: the bottom-up approaches and examples, the usage of social media, and a couple of things about how to close the gap between like intellectuals in Egypt and maybe like the less advantaged people. Bottom-up approaches to development. A couple of examples. Basically, at NM, we incubate social enterprises. That's too close. Fine. Those are social enterprises that are basically at their startup phases. So just an idea from a group of people who feel a need in their community. One of the examples is the Career Entrepreneurship Development Offices, for example, that were started by a group in public universities. Those were the first ever career development offices in public universities in Egypt. And it was a need that two graduates from the Faculty of Engineering had felt after graduation, and assuming that because I graduated from the Faculty of Engineering, I used to get good scores, that I would have all those employers waiting for me. And that, of course, was not the case. So, and it was very clear that their counterparts graduating from private universities had a system to support them actually complement their education with the skills they need, with being ready for the job market and so on. And this very group got incubated at Nahdat al-Mahrusa. We worked with the International Youth Foundation to actually support them with the resources they need, link them with the universities, had an advisory board to open the doors at universities, and we were able to actually create the first ever career development office in a public university. Those offices are being rolled out now to all public universities in Egypt, and it's a very locally grown initiative to solve an issue in our education. Comparing this to other programs that worked on reforming education or trying to improve the quality of education before, the amount of money that was spent on this model versus the amount of money that was spent on all the other initiatives that I personally worked on to reform education and the results of this versus the results of that is, I mean, there is no point of comparison even. So that's one example. Another example is basically people who live in areas where the Nile flowers, where the Nile is basically a huge problem there. And this group of young people came together and decided to, instead of just having this issue prevailing in their communities, they will just do recycling for agricultural waste. They studied the Nile flowers very well, understood that it's full of very good stuff for making animal feed, for example, paper, biogas, and I mean, they changed the problem, a very huge one, into something that was very successful, and they are now building their social enterprise to start actually recycling this agricultural waste. So those are the examples that we're talking about, that people feel the need in their community and come up with a solution that they know that it will work. And they take into consideration all the things that need to be taken into consideration. They understand the restrictions, they understand the culture, and it's better to support those locally planned initiatives rather than just assuming development can come top-down. With the role of social networking and media, last year we had a partnership with Yahoo for Good Foundation, and of course with all the social media that Yahoo's working with, we were a little bit pushed hard to use social media, and it proved very well to connect people and to get them engaged, know about the program, raise awareness about the whole idea of social entrepreneurship, for example. I mean, before that program and after this program, the role of social media had impacted so much the awareness of what is social entrepreneurship, for example, in Egypt. With Google, we're having this program to use the platform for YouTube, for example, to educate people about different things, maybe have some lessons for the younger ones, but also showing role models, their successes, stories, and so on. So basically raising awareness, educating people, and so on. And this is, I think, is the role of the civil society in bridging the gap between the intellectuals and those who are a little bit disadvantaged, is that you use the tools available and the knowledge that you have to simplify it in a way that you can actually communicate the message in ways that others would understand as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And just building on what Jackie has said, because I think it's very similar, the approach I will take, but maybe from the international NGO perspective, and to the points that Dr. Owais had made about how you enable the competent, capable, extraordinary people that are already in Egypt, the bottom-up development discussion, and also this issue of how you bridge the divide between those perhaps intellectuals and those, you know, the reality on the ground. From our perspective, the real way you do that is you create, and something that I'd mentioned before, but maybe getting a little bit more detail on it, is you create platforms for those that are best equipped, that are best knowledgeable, locally respected, well-regarded individuals and institutions to play a role in a very constructive and also tangible role in the redevelopment of Egypt. And, you know, that's a broad statement, but it, you know, it can be sort of broken out into concrete elements that can actually be executed upon. Very simply, you know, a quick but thorough consultative process, where you talk to individuals from different sectors, public sector, private sector, civil society, find out who is that's respected. I mean, right now you're seeing that happening in Egypt where, you know, you have a bit of a witch hunt happening, of course, but you're also seeing those individuals that did have the respect of the people that maybe had been turned away by the regime initially or left the regime because they were upset about what was going on, and people knew it. And so you go around, you look for them, you think about it, and you consult with locals that know what they're doing, and you find those individuals. And then I'd say two other things. One is you create a platform for them to execute on projects and activities that actually have concrete results. And part of that will be, you know, we talk a lot in the international development community about massive sums of money, you know, $165 million that is now being put forward by U.S. Agency for International Development for the redevelopment of Egypt. Well, that's great, but at the end of the day, with low-capacity organizations, as we talked about, you know, we need to be splitting that up into $100,000 increments, and you need to be coupling it with significant capacity building support, technical support to individuals on the ground who are respected that can actually execute and do something if given the right platform and capabilities to do it. And then third and finally, stick with it. So once they have actually been able to show some success, give them more. Right, show that they have actually accomplished something and say, wow, you know, it has come forward. You know, the career development model that Jackie had mentioned. I mean, we're not talking about small potatoes here, but it took quite an effort. They took 2 to 3 years to get firmly established in the university environment, and we're talking about a university of 200,000 people that didn't have a single job placement center on that campus formally. It's a kind of a shocking to those of us in the United States that went to higher education that this kind of service didn't exist. Well, once that office was established, don't walk away. Give it a little bit more funds. Be able to show the platform that you had developed has that greater impact so that those individuals that you've supported are able to accomplish great things. And I should mention at this point, they have over 10,000 students going through this just one university office, plus, you know, the outreach services that they're using through social media and otherwise every year. So there is concrete impacts that can be shown, but you've got to actually really be, you know, executing in a way that allows that to happen.
Thank you. We could probably spend a day on each of these questions, but I'll take a few of them. First, in terms of the role of syndicates and judges clubs, I mean, gradually over the past several years, we saw slowly the state closing in on the space for those institutions. Though in the past, judges' clubs, for example, were led by independent judges who were leading the independent judiciary movement. More and more of those clubs fell under the leadership of the NDP and were essentially co-opted by the state. And we saw that with other syndicates as well. And they also, their regulatory environment made them no longer relevant. So these compulsory memberships for certain syndicates that excluded actually a large number of the new professionals. For example, journalists and teachers for the most part now are being hired under temporary contracts. So they're not even part of the established syndicates. So what happened is a lot of the independent activists within these institutions ended up forming independent, again, civic organizations, because there was still that loophole where NGOs could register as civic companies or law companies and fall under the radar of the state. So I imagine now with the regulatory environment opening up a little bit more, we'll probably see more developments. There already were a couple of independent unions that have been established over the past couple of years, and I imagine we'll see more of those. In terms of the question on women's rights and supporting women's rights, I mean, women have been an essential part of the reform movement in Egypt, even before the January 25th revolution, but everybody saw them on the square. And even before that, there have been very active women's organizations. And even a lot of the new generation organizations have been very keen on gender mainstreaming across their programs, within their staff, and also in terms of how they respond to their programs and including women. I think that there's two key things when we talk about women's rights in Egypt. One, it's very important not to accept cosmetic reforms. We've seen a lot of cosmetic reforms dealing with women's rights. For example, the quota for women, there's been some criticism of that from women's rights organizations in the sense that it created a separate ballot. So you're not educating, you're not instilling the mentality among political parties to nominate women in as part of their core candidates. I think one women's rights activist that I spoke to called it a separate car for women. That's something that needs to be very, looked at closely and responded to. Another thing is, unlike, for example, in Morocco, where you saw a strong women's movement in the reform of the Madawana and the personal status laws, there's not really, contemporary women's rights movement in Egypt. There's many women's rights organizations. They're somewhat divisive. Sometimes there's attempts to coordinate, but usually the coordination is around specific issues and not as a larger kind of, what is the roadmap? What is the vision for what is needed to empower women effectively in Egypt? Finally, with regards to the internet and telecommunications and how we use social networking sites, at the NED, one of our key priorities over the past couple of years has been to support this innovative use of new technology and digital media. And, this whole question and debate over the social, the Facebook revolution or the Twitter revolution, I think simplifies the reality of the fact that this was a very, very long-term process in Egypt. It wasn't just, a big bang and a Facebook group that led to a revolution, but many different key players that led up to that critical moment. In terms of the types of programs that we've supported, for example, since 2005, there's been an emergence of youth-led organizations that have really pioneered the use of film, social networking sites, using YouTube, Bamboozer, SMS for community mobilization, disseminating information, and essentially marinating society for the events that happened on January 25th. There was a lot of all of those who were on Facebook saw tons of activity related to civic and democratic ideas. But I would also add that I think there was a Washington Post article that was published recently that said that there were roughly 35,000 or 42,000 Facebook groups or pages established in Egypt in January alone. So there's a plethora of these different groups. It's not just about creating a Facebook group isn't going to start a revolution. The fact that this was so successful in Egypt is that the digital activists had a pulse on the society. So they created the products that could connect with what everybody else was thinking. The society that had been so afraid of political participation for such a long time, clicked on these links that talked about, freedom and democracy and human rights because they can connect to it. So I think that sums up my comments.
Thanks, Shadi. I'm afraid, folks, that we have five panelists and 5 minutes, and I do want to give each of them an opportunity to leave you with one key message that I think coming out of the discussion they feel you should walk away with. So unfortunately, we won't have time for further questions. I do take it from all of the hands that are in the air that it's a topic where we might sponsor another discussion at a later time as the revolution, as I've heard people call it. I'm always very careful, having spent many years in the World Bank, to avoid words like revolution. Continues to evolve in Egypt. I think what I'll try to do is go in the reverse order of the way in which people gave their presentations, which unfortunately puts a burden on Shadi, since she just spoke last answering questions, to be the first to give us your 1 minute takeaway.
My 1 minute takeaway is I would say that the most critical element and you know incredible element of Egyptian civil society is the activists there. There are really incredible and creative, perseverance young activists in Egypt who have been able to accomplish things that have, you know, fascinated the world. And I think that all of our support and attention needs to be paid to that group and how to institutionalize what they've created. Again, great activists, very weak institutions. So we have to build on what we have and transform this individual talent into institutional talent that could be sustained over the longer term. I think that's it.
You know, I think I think that from my perspective, if you look at the events of the last few months, I mean, it's really quite shocking that one of the largest Arab, Islamic, or majority Muslim countries in the world carried the legacy forward of Gandhi. I mean, that you would see a huge peaceful revolution in large part. Enabling a whole new playing field to be created. And it is something that is both, you know, I mean, extraordinary from so many different angles, but also gives us huge hope, but candidly also gives us a lot of pause in terms of how we create, you know, a framework that this society can really build itself for the long term. And I think that is a real tension point where you have so much hope and aspiration that has come out of this, but yet, you know, so many challenges that now are going to have to be confronted. I mean, as I think as folks have said, you know, the ability of everyone to sort of pinpoint one issue, which was freedom, you know, getting rid of an oppressive regime and a dictator. Well, that was, as we all know, the easy part. The rebuilding of a society is going to take years and years and years. And I guess my sort of final takeaway in all of this, and, you know, hopefully we can work together very closely with local NGOs as well as the international groups that are out there to help, is finding some concrete paths forward. I think that's really the key. If we can really focus on what sorts of initiatives, efforts that can show some real impact, do it quickly, build some momentum, and show people that there is a future. Because you know, the countervailing trend of not having any progress being made and a feeling of just constant challenge is not one we want to be addressing. And that's probably where I'd leave it.
1 minute. Okay. I would say actually that I want to leave you with this, that Egyptians are very capable people. They're very special. They're very creative, innovative, sarcastic. I mean, they're very special in their own way, and they have their solutions. And I think what we need currently is just to support things to happen in this very Egyptian way. The need for strong institutions is, I mean, it is something that we need now more than ever, to have institutions to be able to support those Egyptians actually build the Egypt that they have been dreaming of. And last but not least is, again, bottom-up approaches to development. So just listen to, I mean, those who are donors here or people who are organizations wanting to support Egypt, just listen to Egyptians and just trust the advice that they will give you.
Thank you. I think I would like to emphasize the short term. I think we really need to get Egypt back to work, producing, hiring, and employing. The fundamentals of the Egyptian economy is good, and there are things that you cannot take away from Egypt. Like the genius of the location, like the Suez Canal, it's the trade hub, And I really encourage you and the U.S. companies and U.S. government to support the Egyptian economy at this very critical time. It's time to – there are opportunities in Egypt and even more now. Schumacher, the Formula One guy, said – and they ask him, how do you always win? He says, when I see an accident, everybody's taking the foot off the accelerator, I put it down. So this is an opportunity for companies, for everybody to really support Egypt and the Egyptian economy. And I really stress that this is the time, because if we don't get through this short term, it's going to be very difficult. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, as important as some of the other countries in the region are, whether Libya, Bahrain, so on, it really comes down to Egypt. The whole region is watching how this transition will go. Egypt is the most populous country and a bellwether for the region. So there's a lot at stake here, and we have to get it right. And this is where I think the U.S. and the international community have a major role to play. As Jackie said, yes, Egyptians are capable, and that's certainly the case, and it's important for there to be indigenous ownership over this process. At the same time, rarely do democratic transitions succeed without some kind of Western engagement, and that's been the case in Eastern Europe and Latin America, where the U.S. and Europe have played at times, somewhat surprisingly, a positive role. So perhaps it's possible in the case of the Middle East and particularly Egypt as well. And we've seen how the post-revolutionary phase or the revolutionary phase has become somewhat uneven, and we've seen more and more challenges. And that's why it's very important for the U.S. to engage creatively and to make sure that Egypt is still very high, if not the highest country on the priority list in the Middle East.
Well, now the most pleasant duty of being the moderator falls to me, which is to begin by thanking all of you for coming, for sharing your afternoon, and for being such a warm and participatory audience. To thank all the speakers for their remarks, and to invite you to stay tuned, because I'm sure this won't be the last conversation we have on this subject.